Welcome to the City Clubs of Eugene's April 7th, 2017 program, editing your news feeds, facts, alternative facts, propaganda, and just plain BS. This is the 26th program in our current programming year. I'm James Baldock, past president and City Club board member. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. Become a member at thecityclubofeugene.org. A few updates. We've recently sent out a membership survey, both that you can go to our Facebook page to access, and our members also got it through email. We'd ask that you fill it out so we can help plan our future better. In addition, our April 21st program, Our Representative Democracy, Can It Survive?, is with Speakerman Congressman Peter DeFazio. It will be held at the UO Knight Law Library. To attend, and this is very important, you must RSVP by next Thursday, April 13th. You can go to our website to make your reservation if you're a City Club member. Non-members who order lunch will also get a reservation. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Housing and Community Services Agency, HASCA, of Lane County. HASCA is committed to providing safe, affordable, and energy-efficient housing for low-income families, elderly citizens, and persons with disabilities. Today's program is coordinated by John Belcher. I'll have step up here and introduce the speakers.
Thanks for that introduction, James, and thanks for helping coordinate today's program. I'm beginning to wonder if I should stop planning forums for City Club. I put together our annual gifts for the city on last December 16th, and we had one of our major winter storms, and the power went out all over town. Today, we have high winds and power outages. Given that our subject today is truth and media, I'm wondering whether there will be a headline on Facebook saying, Eugene City Club controls the weather. So, we have invited a journalist to tell us how we can distinguish fake news, or as Kellyanne Conway dubs it, alternative facts, in today's print and electronic media. Todd Milburn is an investigative reporter and journalism instructor at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. He's a former staff writer at the Sacramento Bee. He teaches courses on multimedia storytelling, telling, media entrepreneurship, and investigative reporting. His experiences include editing an international business magazine in Prague, Czechoslovakia, where he helped their reporters learn how to distinguish fact from fiction after exiting a communist regime where disinformation was the norm. He got his start in newspapers at the Modesto Bee, where his investigation of a multi-million-dollar housing scheme landed a CEO in prison and inspired a new state law on predatory lending. At the Sacramento Bee, Milburn roamed the state as an enterprise reporter, filling front page dispatches on everything from wildfires to political scandals to the plight of a tiny mountain town that had no telephone service in 2008. He's also worked in broadcast journalism, serving as interim executive producer and on-air reporter at KVAL. Milburn holds an undergraduate degree in political science from the University of Minnesota and an MBA from the University of Oregon, where his studies focused on building new enterprise business models for journalism in the digital age. And when it comes time for our first questioner, who could be a better first questioner to find the truth in Todd's presentation than Camilla Mortensen, editor of the Eugene Weekly? This is what I learned about her from the web. She has a BA in folklore, a master's in folklore and mythology, and a PhD in comparative literature. She's been reporting for the Eugene Weekly since 1987 and has been its editor for the past year. You will have to check with her to find out if the internet is accurate in reporting that she competes in equestrian triathlon and lives in a 1975 Airstream trailer. Now, when it's your turn to question Todd, be extra diligent. He's already presented this program to the Springfield and Salem City Clubs, so he will be well-seasoned and prepared. So, without further ado, here's Todd.
Well, hi, everybody. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, John. I'm really excited to be here and to be talking with you all today about this really important and timely subject. I really appreciate the invitation to come here and do this. So as John mentioned, I've spent most of my career as a journalist, and that's something I'm really proud of. And one thing I think you should know about journalists is that we tend to understand the world through stories. So you can throw all the facts and charts and data points at us that you want, but it's not really going to mean much unless there's a good story there too. Something that makes the information human and memorable. So in that spirit, I wanted to share with you today three stories. Three stories that I think illustrate some of the forces that are driving fake news. One story is about money, one is about manipulation, and the other is about the mayhem of today's digital news environment. Then I'm going to give you a few solutions that hopefully you can take with you and use to empower your work as informed citizens. So, three stories, three solutions, 20 minutes. Sound good? All right. Let's start with the one about mayhem. This is a story that takes place in Austin, Texas, the day after the election. A guy named Eric Tucker was driving home from his job as a marketing manager when he saw a small fleet of buses parked downtown. Now, a bunch of buses wouldn't normally be something to notice, but there was a huge anti-Trump rally taking place that day. And Tucker, who happened to be a Trump supporter himself, had heard something online about protesters being paid and brought in from afar. He wondered, could these buses be evidence of that? So Eric did what pretty much any young man with a smartphone does these days. He snapped a few photos and posted them on Twitter. And he included the message, quote, "Anti-Trump protesters in Austin aren't as organic as they seem. Here are the buses they came in, hashtag fake protests." Now at the time, Tucker had 45 followers on his Twitter account. For those keeping score, 45 is not a very, very high number. Even so, that tweet picked up a lot of momentum and really quickly. So that night, it got posted to the discussion board Reddit, where it drew some 400 comments. The next morning, a conservative site called Free Republic shared Eric's message on Facebook, sparking some 307,000 shares. But it was only getting started. Later that day, none other than the president-elect himself retweeted the information to his global audience. Not bad for a kid who started the day with 45 followers. Meanwhile, back in Austin, a local TV news reporter got an assignment to look into the story. And she did something that neither Eric nor his legion of retweeters thought to do. She picked up the phone and called the company that owned the buses. You'll never guess what she found. It turns out the buses didn't have anything to do with the protests at all. In fact, they were being used as shuttles for a software conference that was happening nearby. They'd been there all week. Eric realized his error, he admitted his mistake, and made a follow-up post. But the damage had been done. The final tally, Eric's incorrect original post, 249,189 likes, 72,365 retweets. The corrected version, 30 likes, 28 retweets. And that's a glimpse into some of the mayhem of today's digital news environment, where an ordinary guy can unwittingly shape the national discussion all through a random tweet. It's also a modern-day reminder of the age-old warning that a falsehood can travel the world before the truth even puts its shoes on. The second story I want to share with you today is about money. This story takes place more than 6,000 miles away in the town of Valais, Macedonia, in the former Yugoslavia. For decades, the ceramics industry helped power the local economy there. But for the past year or so, it's been the production of misinformation. more than 100 fake news sites opened in the town of just 55,000 people before and shortly after the election. They were operated by men like Boris, an 18-year-old web designer who loves video games and has big dreams of one day owning a BMW. He was interviewed by a reporter from Wired magazine. Boris told the reporter that he was out of work, looking to make a few bucks, when a friend told him how much he was earning creating viral content tied to U.S. politics. His buddy said a few viral stories could easily bring in $5,000 or more in ad revenue on Google. And that's a really big deal when the average salary in Macedonia is $371 a month. So Boris decided to get in the game. He bought domains like politicshall.com and usapolitics.co. The site sounded sort of legit, but the content, he admitted, was certainly not. Boris said he would basically copy stories from extreme websites in the U.S. and then add punchy, sensational headlines. And to his astonishment, the articles took off. Some of the biggest hits ran with headlines like, "Pope Francis shocks the world, endorses Donald Trump for president." And WikiLeaks confirms Hillary sold weapons to ISIS. According to an analysis by BuzzFeed, these weren't just one-off stories. They turned out to be the two most widely shared political articles, real or fake, on all of Facebook. Boris told the magazine that he was agnostic about American politics. The main thing for him was the cash, and of course, all the parties and the champagne that it financed. Since the election, Google has made it harder for sites that trade in fake news to collect ad revenue, and Facebook is now rolling out a tool that flags disputed articles. But the underlying economics of digital news remain largely the same. With so few people willing to straight up pay for news, advertising continues to play a commanding role. And that can make it really tempting for writers. Maybe not to push full-on fake news, but at least to set aside context and nuance and pursue nothing but raw clicks. The third and final story I want to mention is about manipulation and influence. While fake news can be easily spotted with a trained eye, there are deeper forces at work in the media that don't always leave an obvious trace. Consider the story about Uranium One. This story all began when a hedge fund billionaire commissioned a former political operative to dig up dirt on then-candidate Hillary Clinton. He and his team had noted that cutbacks in investigative reporting at American newspapers, and they saw this as an opportunity to fill that gap. So the operative spent a year doing extensive, well-funded research and made what he considered an explosive finding. In a nutshell, the story claimed that Hillary Clinton had allowed a Russian firm to gain control of some 20% of the American uranium reserve through the takeover of a Canadian company called Uranium One. The kicker was that some of the Russian money men involved in the deal had also given huge donations to the Clinton Foundation, which raised questions of impropriety. The story, as you might imagine, got massive play on conservative news sites like Breitbart or World News Daily or InfoWars. And you know where I'm going with this, right? The story turned out to be total fake news, right? Not so fast. In fact, after reading the book, two New York Times reporters dug into the findings. They reviewed hundreds of public documents on the matter. And they found that the gist of it was actually true. And they ran a front page story based on their independent corroboration. Now, to be fair, the Times found that there was nothing actually shady about the deal. It was all perfectly legal and above board. But the verifiable public documents showed and gave support to the operative's underlying facts. Of course, that nuance was lost in the overwhelming number of repackaged stories and social media shares that reverberated across the internet, and as well as the guy who was just down I-5 from us, near Sutherland, who hung an effigy of Hillary on the side of the highway alongside a sign that said simply, "Treason, Uranium One." I bring up that story because I think it illustrates how important it is to think critically about where our information really is coming from these days. Keep in mind, there are right now half as many newspaper reporters working today as there were just 15 years ago. Half. And that means that there's a huge opening for non-journalistic entities to shape and, yeah, sometimes manipulate the discourse. In fact, the overwhelming majority of federal public records requests under the Freedom of Information Act no longer come from news organizations themselves, but from corporations and advocacy groups on both sides. That makes it more important than ever for us to consider the source of our information, plus the funding and the agenda behind it. So there you go. There you have it. Three problems, three stories about fake news and disinformation. And that might leave you wondering, so what am I supposed to do with all this? How do I make sense out of the news that I'm getting? How do I sort through it all? Well, I've got a few, three solutions that might help. And the first thing is I think it's critical that we be deliberate about the news we consume. So let's take a moment and think about how we're consuming news right now. Many of you may read a physical newspaper or watch TV, but more and more we're getting our news on our phones. We've got a minute or two to kill while we're waiting for our kids or waiting for the bus. So we open Facebook, we scroll through, we see what's happening, and it's a way to waste time. It's not a way to seriously contemplate current events. So one of the biggest things I recommend is being deliberate about the news you consume. That means setting aside specific, dedicated time in our days when we can really dig in to what's going on. Maybe it's in the morning or after the kids go to bed, but whenever it is, it's a time to focus and really think about what we're reading. Which leads me to my second point, and that is to be deliberate about our news sources as well. With so many news organizations out there, it can be hard to keep a running tally of what's legit and what's not. That's why I recommend picking a select few, and really, like, no more than two or three that you really pay close attention to. Do your homework first. It's funny, but our family recently bought a dishwasher, and we labored over that choice for weeks. We visited multiple stores, we checked out floor models, we read up on consumer reports. We did all the things you do when you're about to make a big family purchase. But for some reason, we don't do that same amount of diligence when it comes to the media that shapes how we view the world. So take a moment, assess your news needs. What features are you looking for? Are you in the market for something partisan or an outlet that's going to give it to you straight? How important is investigative reporting to you? One key thing I think to look for when you're assessing news organizations is that outlet's corrections policy. It's a great way to gauge how committed they are to accuracy and transparency. I'm a digital subscriber to the Washington Post, and they have a really transparent policy when it comes to corrections. And you can bet if a news organization is able to admit when it's wrong, there's probably a good chance that they're getting most of their stuff right. So research those questions, find organizations that match and fit your values, and then pay for them. Why are you all laughing? One of the key things to making this whole enterprise of journalism work is having people actually pay for the content. So right now is the time for all of us to step up, subscribe, or donate to an organization of your choice if you haven't already. It'll help you take some ownership over that news you're consuming. You'll build a relationship with it. Free speech and First Amendment groups deserve support as well. There's been lots of talk lately about opening up libel laws and journalists as the opposition. And groups like Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press and others are on the front lines right now, fighting to protect your right to know as a citizen. Of course, there are tons more of recommendations, and maybe some of those will bubble up in the question and answer. But the third and final solution I want to leave you with is to cultivate your sense of skepticism. Now, I don't want you to be cynical. That's actually a way to give away your power. But a healthy sense of skepticism is critical. And this is doubly true when it comes to news that aligns with your political beliefs. My wife and I call it the fist pump rule. If it ever happens that news comes across your feed and it makes you want to thrust your fist in the air in righteous indignation and claim, I knew it, you need to check that emotion. Confirmation bias is real, and it affects people of all political persuasions and education levels. So be skeptical. Think before you share. Double-check your facts. Or another way to put it is to remember what one of my favorite editors once told me about skepticism. If your mom says she loves you, check it out. Your mom probably loves you. But remember, it's always good to have a second source. So thank you for your time this afternoon. That concludes my remarks, and I'm excited to answer a few questions.
All right, and now we're going to have our first questioner, Camilla Mortson, come on up and ask the first question.
And John, thank you for that lovely introduction, but the fake news part of that one is I was 15 in 1987, but I did start at The Weekly at 2007. For the radio listeners who can't see, I'm still blonde. So as a newspaper editor, one of the things I puzzle over is how to get my readers to want to check the facts. How do I get readers to want to eat their broccoli and not just fist pump their ice cream? So by way of example, we ran a story some weeks ago on marijuana-induced vomiting syndrome. It is actually a thing. We talked to Peace Health. They have a number of cases in which people who are frequent smokers of marijuana begin uncontrollably vomiting. And the only cure is to stop smoking marijuana. And most marijuana smokers know that marijuana often quells nausea, so they smoke more. It was an interesting story, and the immediate response was, this is fake news. I smoke weed, I don't puke. Rather than look at sources, they of course looked at their own sort of experience and their lack of wanting to believe that marijuana would induce vomiting. How do I get readers, how do we get readers to forego the joy of sharing a story that reflects their beliefs in favor of reading a story that might counter their beliefs?
Gosh, I knew it was going to be a good one. I mean, that is absolutely one of the central questions that journalism is facing today. And, you know, a couple solutions I think are kind of bubbling out there, and you see them, and they're happening, but they're maybe not common practice yet. One is, I think, the idea of radical transparency, being much more open about how you choose news stories, the ones you select, and incorporating the public, your readers and audience, into that process. So I'm thinking in particular about, in the run-up to the election, there was a reporter at the Washington Post, David Fahrenthold, who may just win like a Pulitzer Prize in the next few weeks. But he was doing an investigation of Donald Trump's charitable giving, or lack thereof. And what he did was he open-sourced that. And so he brought in people that were following him on social media channels. He brought in people who wanted to know more, and there was a sense of quest about it. And he was very open, kind of holding his notebook out for anybody to see. And I think any way you can bring a sense of ownership to your community, one of the experiments we've done at the journalism school has been to focus a lot on community engagement. And instead of, you know, coming up with stories where everybody's huddled around in an office talking about, you know, reporters and editors, what we're going to do today, actually bringing people in and asking them, okay, tell us more about your lived experience. What's been bothering you? What's been on your mind? And I think the more you can reflect those voices in your news copy and in your story selection, I think the more investment people are going to have. And I think you can maybe start to break down some of those silos that keep us apart.
Now we'll break for about 5 minutes to formulate questions from each table, and we'll return with audience questions. Remember, only City Club members are allowed to ask questions at the mic.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the April 7th City Club program, editing your news feeds, facts, alternative facts, propaganda, and just plain BS. Support for the City Club of Eugene is from members and sponsors, including Gatos Churnside and Balthrop PC, a local law firm engaging in general civil practice, including family law and estate planning and business and commercial law, and PacInfo Internet Solutions, is a local provider of fast, reliable internet connections. They specialize in all aspects of computer tech support and offer services such as web development and hosting and internet marketing. Todd, I'll have you step up here and answer members' questions. Remember to keep your questions brief.
Well, that's the whole problem with this process. I'm Mary Layton. I've been a City Club member since 2006, and my question really is about brevity. I used to do policy research in Washington, and you'd spend $200,000 or $300,000 of taxpayer money and be told to report it back to the decision maker in four bullets, mm-hmm. at the very most. So how do you choose, and this was a table question, how do you pick details that people will want to know more about so you can get them past the first paragraph?
Oh, that's a craft question. That's an excellent question. I mean, one thing we talk about a lot in a lot of my news reporting classes is this idea. It's called a nut graph. So I don't know if anybody's heard of. I'm sure Camilla has. I don't know if anybody else has heard about what a nut graph is, but it's two sentences, and it needs to be in every story. It can be at the very beginning or within the first three or four paragraphs, and it's got to answer two questions. And the first question is, what is this story about? Second question is, why should anybody care about it now? And every story has to go through that test. And what the nut graph does is it sort of makes a promise to the reader about what's going to be in there. So if they've made it that far and gotten to the nut of the story, there should be a promise there. And once you get them in, you know, a lot of the creative part of the job takes over, right? You know, it's not just to convey information, but also to capture imagination too, right? And so any sort of human details, right, the more you can make things about people and their authentic experiences as opposed to statistics and numbers, I mean, you need that stuff in there to bolster and give your story credibility and rigor and all of that, but that's not why people read, right? You know, in terms of journalism, I mean, policy is probably much more oriented toward stats and figures and the bullet points, right? And a lot of journalism is like that too, but I think the best work, at least the work that inspires me the most and I try to coach my students on, is to find ways to tell stories that are socially important but that also connect and say something about people and the way we're living. So it's an art more than a science, but it's part of what makes the job challenging and fun.
Policy reporting is actually always about storytelling, except you got to do it in three bullets.
Okay, there you go.
Hi, I'm Susan Conley, City Club member since 2008. Thank you so much for coming and speaking to us. We have a question from one of our non-members that I'm asking on her behalf. What do you think is the most neutral news source today?
Ooh. You know, I think a lot of times we do think of the news environment in that way on a political spectrum, and I, you know, that makes some sense, right? We do have liberal-leaning outlets. We have the Huffington Posts and the Daily Kos's of the world, right? And then we have conservative sites. We have, you know, Fox News, and then we go, you know, Breitbart and some of these other things on the right. So we think about news as a spectrum, and then, you know, your mainstream newspapers, Washington Post, NBC News, some of the CNN might be in the middle, right? Like, so I think if you would ask most people what the spectrum is, it would be something like that. But to me, I think that's the wrong way, or not, that's not the most helpful way to think about it. The way I would think about it as a news consumer is not about where they are politically, but what they're doing to produce original information, right? Because it's really easy and it's pretty inexpensive to take original reporting elsewhere and funnel it through your own political leanings and push that out toward people who already agree with it, right? Right, and I think we see a whole lot of that. I think what's harder to do, and I think especially important right now, are organizations that are putting out fresh, original information that's deeply sourced in public documents and on-the-record interviews that sheds new light on things we're dealing with. So if you're looking for neutral information, it sounds like that question comes from a place of wanting to get the most fair and accurate take. So if you're, you know, taking one of the tips and doing research on your news organization, I would pay particularly close attention. Like, what are the organizations out there that are producing original stuff? They've got reporters who are actually there at those meetings. They're actually putting in, you know, requests to the government to get new information. I think that's a real good way. You follow that, I don't think you could go wrong in terms of the news you're getting.
Hi, I'm Jack Dresser. I'm the National Vice Chair of the Veterans for Peace Working Group on Palestine in the Middle East. And I'm a retired psychologist and research scientist. I read books rather than tweets. And I'm concerned that most American citizens don't. And I'd like you to address three things in connection with the idea of stories. At the large stories, not the little incidental stories. The large stories that the other stories fit into. And I'd like you to address the issue of framing and the heroes and villains of all stories. I speak specifically when I'm very troubled by America's constant wars attacking other nations that have done nothing to us in complete violation of international law over and over and over, decade after decade. And that involves the heroic story about America. We are heroic rescuers as a country. Also, the rotating villains. You have to have a villain. The villain is Saddam, then it's Gaddafi, then it's Assad, and it involves complete misrepresentations of everything. To fit in, but these, all the misrepresentations fit very neatly into the frames that are created, things that would be totally unbelievable otherwise.
Mm-hmm. All right. If I could summon Joseph Campbell to answer that one, I think. I mean, I think you bring up a critical point about framing, right? I mean, reporters aren't, you know, there's this idea of objectivity, right? And that you were supposed to come to the job blank slates, you know, bright-eyed, ready to just accept information as it comes in. And I, I think all of us probably could, you know, would agree on the face of that that's probably not true, right? Right? I mean, reporters have experiences like anybody else has, and prejudices and biases and all that baggage that they bring, not just baggage, but also perspective that they bring to the work that they do. And so part of the challenge, I think, of journalism is to you make sure you keep that sensibility in many respects, but then also are open-minded enough to have those perspectives challenged. We were talking at the table over here about, you know, often there'll be a news meeting in the morning, a reporter will get assigned a story, go out, and they already know what the story is going to be, right? And so they've got a little slot for it available in the newspaper. And you go out, and when you're on the ground talking to people about their lived experience, well, maybe it doesn't exactly fit what you thought it was going to be. And the good reporters, the ones you want to pay attention to and follow, I think are the ones that, yeah, bring a perspective, but then are also open to changing that, right? Because those framings can become cliches, and they can become narratives, and they can, you know, do as much damage as they can good. So keeping it fresh, being open to being challenged, I think those are things you want to look for.
Hey, Linda Jensen, City Club member. One of the difficult things in trying to get unbiased information is that search engines tend to direct you to the kinds of sites that you've looked at in the past, so you get funneled into certain kinds of stories. And I'm wondering if there's techniques that we can use to get around that, but also I'm wondering if there are, or Table was wondering if there are, there's impetus on the part of the companies that do put out that information to get off the stuff that's not factual, you know, if there's something on their part that they're doing to try and correct the situation of getting more polarized because we keep getting, you know, directed to information that's not in the middle.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I mean, you know, we think we go to the internet to learn, and we do, but at the same time, the internet is learning about us, right? Right, there's this idea of, you know, we get these products, we get Google for free, right? With, you know, we are consumers who get that for free, but it turns out we're not actually the consumers of Google. Like, we're the product that ends up getting bundled and sold to advertisers. So that's a real concern. Algorithms are always learning. They're tracking us. They know we've got these baked in confirmation biases that are, you know, making us click on certain things, and there's a big financial model that's underneath all that. So that's absolutely real. In terms of searching, you know, I think, you know, using an array of search terms, I think if you find an article that you are maybe not necessarily suspicious about, but like you really want to make sure you know what you're getting, find another article that corroborates it, right? Like, look for additional sources. That's one way to guard against, you know, some of those biases that creep in. And then you had a second part of your question, which was
whether the companies are doing anything to try and get the facts out.
A little bit, not as much as I would like, considering their financial resources and their control of public mindshare. There are, in fits and starts, there's growing momentum. Like I mentioned just briefly that Facebook is rolling out a new tool that will, for certain articles that are disputed, a little red flag is going to start popping up, so you might start seeing this in the next few months. It'll say, article disputed by Snopes.com or Associated Press. So there is some response to that. I would encourage all of you, you know, there's a lot you can do to directly support journalism, but if you care about this, I mean, contact some of those providers yourself. I mean, public pressure on those companies and corporations is proving effective. So let them know how you feel and that you want to make sure the information you're getting is as accurate as possible.
Sandy Erickson, City Club member. My question is about, sometimes you're talking to someone and they exclaim someplace in the conversation, who does that? You know, And it's a slang, you know, response that you hear a lot of times about a lot of different topics. But I really do want to know who does that. Are there any demographic common denominators that when on the retweeting and the spreading of news that's unverified or something? I understand when people do it for money, but mm-hmm. This idea of something going viral, I mean, are they mm-hmm. mostly younger people, older people, people that live in certain areas? I mean, there's got to be something known about these people because they are a demographic of some sort that mm-hmm. can be measured.
So who's doing this in terms of fake news or just trying to create viral content in general?
Just kind of being susceptible to that, you know, kind of draw of perpetuating something that they know is unverified because, mm-hmm. you know, most mm-hmm. of these people were not there.
Yeah.
So what do we know about those people?
Okay. You know, I do... I'll answer part of that. So there was a study that came out a couple months ago. It was a few Harvard researchers and an MIT researcher. It was in the Columbia Journalism Review. And what they did was they took social media shares, so the viral content that you're talking about, and they mapped it out. So what are the original sources of articles that are being shared? And they did it across the political spectrum. And so they did that, and they learned interesting things about the way our party affiliation can shape what gets shared and what doesn't. And they found some asymmetries. I mean, certainly fake news, bad information gets shared across the political spectrum. But what these researchers found was that people who tended to have a liberal orientation, they would go to liberal sites and they would share viral content from things on the far left, but then they would also tend to come back to more mainstream outlets like your NBC News or CBS or the Washington Post, right? And so they would kind of live from the center to the left. They found something different when they looked at the right side of the spectrum. What they found over there was that a larger number of news consumers would just kind of hang out in that right-wing space. So they would consult with Breitbart News or Fox, but wouldn't come to the mainstream, right? Like they might be paying attention to Fox News, but not also the New York Times, right? And so that study suggests that there is some partisan difference in terms of who shares viral content. And so it's not a whole psychological profile, demographic profile of who does this, but that's at least some glimpse, I think, into that.
So. Greetings. This is Paul Thompson. I've been a City Club member since 2006. Thanks a lot for coming today. Our table was interested in that continuum that you described between having a blind acceptance of information on one hand through a healthy skepticism up to total cynicism, mm-hmm. if you will. So let's pretend for a moment that you're going to write a book which is Skepticism for Dummies. What tools would you put in that book to help especially people who have had decades to form their evaluation skills? What toolkit would you put in there to promote healthy skepticism?
It's a great question. So Carl Sagan actually wrote a book on that, like The Demon Haunted World, and he talks about it from a very like a scientific perspective. And so that would be the toolkit that I would draw on. I think there's a lot you can learn about consuming news by thinking approaching it like a scientist, right? So what do we know about the scientific method, right? You've got a hypothesis, you've got data, you've got testing of that data. You might reformulate your hypothesis, right? And then only at the end are your conclusions, right? And you might also get some other opinions, some peer review throughout that process. So I think that's a really good way to think about how we consume our news, right? We all have hypotheses, right? Our beliefs are not, you know, we might have a certain view of the world that's true to us, but it might not be objectively and like always true. So go through that process. Be open to testing things. So if you get an article that, yeah, makes you want to do that fist bump, it's confirming your hypotheses, double check that, right? Go to another source that is outside of your political affiliation, or maybe a geographic difference, right? Like, look for different ways to corroborate that and test it, and just and try to be open, you know, as much as you can. Like, there, you know, what's the saying? There's, you know, there's two ways to be fooled. One is to believe things that are true, and the other is to not believe things that aren't. Right? Does that make sense logically? You guys, yeah, I think you get it, but I'd think like a scientist.
Karen Seidel, City Club member. I believe the following information is accurate, that Russian hackers are now working to try to influence the results of European elections, just as they did in this country a year ago, particularly Germany and France. Is anything being done by anyone, reputable news organizations, governments, someone else, to stop this?
Yes. So in the German parliament this week is actually legislation that Angela Merkel has said she would support that would allow the government to levy a fine for knowing purveyors of disinformation on social media, right? So in Europe, actually, you're seeing a pretty robust government response. In the Czech Republic, where I worked for some time as a journalist myself about a decade ago, they have a fake news team, more or less, that is government funded. And so you have a little sort of skunkworks kind of agency where they're doing that. They're sifting through information, looking for, you know, potential false stories and how they can, you know, try to stop those in their tracks and send letters to the purveyors of them before they reach a critical mass. So I think in Europe, in Germany and in the Czech Republic, you know, are at least two examples of governments think, you know, saying they have a role there. Now there's another argument to that, right? If you have the government coming in and trying to police what's happening in the public conversation, right, that creates all sorts of potential, you know, in the United States, certainly First Amendment challenges, right? Right. So there's got to be a trade-off there. But certainly in Europe, you are starting to see some governments take action. Yeah.
I'm Ted Taylor, the former editor, and I can take credit for hiring and training Camilla, though I think she's trained me more than I've trained her. Jerry Detelm kind of deputized me, even though I haven't, my membership has lapsed at the moment. I always thought of letters to the editor in a local way as a way for as a fact checking. You know, if you put something wrong that's incorrect in the paper, especially in Eugene, where you got a very sophisticated audience, in Springfield as well, that you're going to get your facts checked there, whether you like it or not. And it's a good process. But I'm wondering if we're talking to the wrong audience here. I was often invited to go to the university and talk to journalism classes about various things, especially ethics and journalism, but rarely, well, only once was I ever invited into the public schools. And I'm thinking maybe that's where we need to be having this conversation. And I bet if teachers in the public schools were said, hey, there's a group of journalists and professors who would be happy to come in and talk to your classes, that they would welcome that. Do you think that's a good idea?
Absolutely.
I'm Jerry Diethelm, a City Club member for a long time. I thought we needed to hear from Ted Taylor, you know, the former editor. Over the years, as I have read the Associated Press, you know, I started to notice that there was a phrase that kept coming up. It said, some people are saying, and then I'd wonder who those people were, you know. And then a little later on in the article, it'd say, other people are saying, you know. And it has to do with this whole business of necessary balance, you know, in the news, and even fake balance, you know, today where the Russians hacking us is equal to an email server sort of thing. So the question is really about the business of striking some kind of the necessity for trying to strike some balance in some of the things that really aren't real balance?
I think what you're talking about is the idea of false equivalence. And you know, one of the things we do, we talk about with our journalism students, and you learn right on is early on, is you want to get both sides, right? He said, she said, right? And somehow, if you have both of these poles of opinion, there are only two. You got both of those. You're going to have a balanced and well-rounded story. And I've never really subscribed to that. I mean, I think if you've got the he said and he's lying to you, and she said and she's lying to you too, I mean, you may be being fair, arguably, to both, if it's a political story, both sides there, but you're certainly not being fair to your audience. And that's what I think we need to reorient our mindset around, is we don't need to think about how are we covering the campaigns, how are we covering these companies, how are we covering these institutions, but how are we serving our community? How are we serving our audience and making sure that they've got the information that they need? Because, yeah, you get, you know, smoke and mirrors from both sides, and it just becomes even more disorienting to try to make sense out of everything.
Hi, I'm Charlie Loeb. As you've pointed out, the proliferation of fake news combined with the decline in the number of actual paid journalists working, it points to the structural problem in providing the expensive work that goes into producing actual journalism. Well, I'm sure with your exhortation, everyone here is going to go out and subscribe to a few more publications when we leave here today. I know that I personally spend time trying to avoid paying for news and still get quality news. I do pay for some things. I try not to for others. But given that a lot of people are never going to pay for news if they have the chance to get something for free, what is the ongoing funding model and the collapse of traditional funding models, what is the ongoing funding model that's going to produce real information going forward and support these sources that are actually producing real news? And can you give some specific examples of some alternative funding models that are really working to produce good news?
Yeah, excellent question. I mean, I think one of the key things going forward, to find an audience and create a community and also build a business model, like those things are going to be all deeply integrated. I think what we've seen on the internet is a business model that's, let's spread it as thin as we can. Let's get as many articles out there. Let's get as much, you know, as many reporters doing as much work as quickly as possible, right? And see how many, you know, how much money we can generate with clicks on this, you know, army of content. And I think some of the interesting innovations that we're seeing are, well, you know, is that just spreading us thin? Somebody's going to click on a, you know, kind of quick turnaround, poorly sourced, you know, story that's valuable for the, you know, next 10 minutes until there's a rewrite. I'm like, how are we going to make a deep sort of go of that? And so you've got organizations around the country. There's a lot of things happening in the nonprofit world where community foundations and tax-deductible donations are supporting journalism outfits. I think one that comes to mind is the Texas Tribune, based out of Austin, Texas. And their business model is not necessarily just to be first, although they do have that. They do try to be on top of things, but they try to facilitate community conversations. So they make a lot of money through events, and those events will be sponsored by corporations, but also institutions within the state. And it's sort of the idea of a newspaper as a community hub. And there can be a lot of value in that, bringing together, you know, people who are involved in public policy, involved in the business world, and then regular citizens in these dynamic and interesting ways. And so I think those are really worth exploring and thinking about deeply, more deeply, like how can we use the news not just to tell stories, but also to create community, and creating community can create value and business might follow.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. You gave a few examples of what people could do because we are so gullible in absorbing all of these things. My first thought was about the fact that in schools nowadays, they're teaching kids how to play chess. You make one move, it has all kinds of implications. I love that. A person on our table said she went through debate, and the debate, she had to defend a position that she didn't know, that she didn't agree with. That kind of critical thinking is being accomplished in the schools, where they don't cut those programs like they have been doing, even at South.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching critical thinking seems to be a key to our reacting with fear.
Absolutely. Amen. Amen. I think critical thinking is absolutely essential in this whole conversation, right? And that applies to news, but it applies to so many other aspects, and getting kids when they're young how to think critically, right? That could be problem solving, you know, out in the woods or whatever it might be. But yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Okay. All right. Before we thank our guests today, there are a few quick announcements. The City Club is very appreciative of our sponsors, including the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County, Gatos, Turnside, and Balthrop PC Attorneys, and PacInfo Internet Solutions. And thank you to KLCC for airing our programs on Monday at 6:30 p.m. and to Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs. Next week's program will be an opportunity to meet candidates for Bethel. Will be an opportunity to meet candidates for Bethel and Eugene 4J school boards. Each candidate is seeking a four-year position on one of the local school boards. Come and join us to hear from the candidates about their values and ideas for education. The program on April 21st is our Representative Democracy, Can It Survive? The speaker is Congressman Peter DeFazio. The location is the UO Knight Library. To attend, you must RSVP by next Thursday, April 13th. Lunch is available. Further information can be found on our website and in the packets on the tables that have been provided. Additional information about future programs and membership can be found on the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. And once again, I'd ask all of our members and non-members to please take our Eugene City Club survey. It's very important for us to figure out where and how we can go forward as a club. Now, let's give a big thank you and round of applause to Todd Milburn. That concludes our program for today.